Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Dawn Cornegus, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is the man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests who appear on STEM Talk.
Hi, Dawn. Great to be here with you today.
So our guest today is Google's Director of Research, Dr. Peter Norvig. He is one of the world's leading authorities on AI and the author of Artificial Intelligence, A Modern Approach, which is the leading textbook in the field. Before joining Google in 2001, Peter was at NASA Ames during the same time that Ken was actually there.
That's right, Dawn. I actually recruited Peter to head up the Computational Sciences Division at NASA Ames while I was out there.
But before we get today's interview with Peter, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and we are especially appreciative of all the wonderful 5-star reviews that have been piling up. As we announced in several earlier episodes, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing iTunes, Google, Stitcher, and other podcast apps for the wittiest and most lavishly praise-filled reviews to read on STEM Talk. As always, if you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt.
Today, our winning review was posted by Ta Keela Phillips and is titled Jam-Packed Podcast. It reads, I love listening to podcasts that open my mind and give me a glimpse about different aspects of science. The guests and hosts are truly remarkable people and inspire me to say, not even the sky is the limit.
Well, thank you, Ta Keela Phillips. And thank you to all of the other STEM Talk listeners who helped STEM Talk become such a great success.
Okay, and now on to our interview with Dr. Peter Norvig.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Hi, welcome to STEM Talk. I'm your host, Dawn Cornegus, and joining us today is Peter Norvig. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, and also joining us is Ken Ford.
Hi, Dawn, and hello, Peter.
So, Peter, I read an interview that Forbes magazine did with you a few years ago, and this quote you gave them stood out to me. You said, I don't care so much whether what we are building is real intelligence. We know how to build real intelligence. My wife and I did it twice, although she did a lot more of the work. We don't need to duplicate humans. That's why I focus on having tools to help us rather than duplicate what we already know how to do. We want humans and machines to partner and do something that humans and machines cannot do on their own. I really liked what you said, especially since that's the heart of what we do here at IHMC. So can you talk about that belief and how it has influenced your career over the past 3 decades?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think Ken was influential to me 20 years ago. He was talking about this idea of a cognitive prothesis. I prefer to use the word tool because sometimes it's enhancing what you already have. Sometimes it's bringing it up to normal. Sometimes it's exceeding what would otherwise be normal. But the idea is we want to make life better for us. And so we need the tools to do that. We don't want to replace us because we still want to have our place in the world. We want to enjoy contributing to society. So we want the tools to enable us to do that better.
Perfect. And I'd like to back up just a little bit and talk about your background. You grew up in Boston, and I hear that as a teenager, you wrote to your local newspaper, the Boston Globe, complaining about the newspaper's innumeracy and sloppy language in science reporting. Is that true?
Yeah, I wrote a couple letters to the editor when I was probably like in junior high school. One of them was about like the temperature on the sun, which they were talking about in millions of degrees centigrade, and then they converted to Fahrenheit by multiplying by 9/5 and subtracting 32 million when they should have subtracted 32. So I complained about that. And another one I remember was a story about an inventor, which I was very interested in at the time. How do you be an inventor? How do you be inventive? And this inventor said, well, I like to shake things up and do things differently. And he says, every morning I shave a different side of my face first. And I thought, well, if he only has two sides of his face, then that's just as deterministic as shaving the same size first every day.
Maybe he had a hexagonal face or something.
That might have done it, yeah. But I didn't know about the idea of Kolmogorov complexity theory then, but intuitively I had the idea.
You did. That's great stuff. I understand that your father was a math professor and your mother was an English literature professor. In high school, even though a teacher suggested a career as journalism for you, perhaps as a science reporter, you decided to learn to program. I think it was in the programming language BASIC.
Mm-hmm.
So you were taking a class in linguistics, and that led you to start thinking about using computers to process natural language. Can you talk a little about this?
I think I was lucky. You know, there's a story about Bill Gates being similarly lucky that he grew up at a time in which he had access to a computer in high school, or maybe it was junior high, and that was unusual at the time. So that was also true for me. I grew up in a wealthy suburb of Boston, and we had access to a computer. You know, I think it was a PDP-1 or something. You know, it's sort of far below the level of 100th of the phone you have now. But it was a computer nevertheless, and we also had a linguistics class in my high school. So I took both those classes, and I thought, you know, what they're telling me in linguistics class seems like a mathematical way of thinking about language, and what they're telling me in computer class seems like those two could connect. So I asked my teacher about that, and the teacher wisely said, yes, you could do something with that, but probably not with what you know so far. So I had to wait until I was in college to pursue that further.
And so after high school, you attended Brown University, and while majoring in applied mathematics, you took a psychology class that was taught from a cognitive science perspective. So is that what led you to start thinking more about artificial intelligence?
Yeah. So started with just learning programming, learning systems, and so on, but was interested in artificial intelligence and took sort of the nascent classes that they had. There wasn't very much at the time. I remember when I was a senior, I went to a job talk for a new assistant professor, Gene Charniak, and said, wow, you know, I wish I was coming back next year so that I could take a class from him, a famous AI researcher in probabilistic theory and natural language and now getting into neural nets. But I didn't have that chance because I graduated and went on. And I went off and worked as a programmer for 2 years and then decided, it took me 4 years to get tired of college and only 2 years to get tired of work. Maybe I should go back to grad school. And I said, since I'd lived in New England all my life, maybe it's time to try something new. So I applied to Berkeley and Stanford, and both schools unanimously agreed I should go to Berkeley.
So then you enrolled in the computer science department for your PhD at UC Berkeley. Is that correct?
That's right.
So I find it interesting that when you were at Berkeley in the early 80s, this was just after a period of reduced funding and interest in artificial intelligence that became known as the AI winter. What motivated you to continue to pursue AI anyway?
I think there were waves. So there certainly was, while I was in grad school, there was also a boom where the AI trade shows were greatly increasing in size, not quite to what they are now, but certainly up from the low point. So it went up and down. But you know, I thought of it as a kind of academic study and not as an industry. And so it didn't bother me really what the funding levels were, right? So, you know, if I had been interested in Renaissance Italian poetry, then I probably would have done that, and I would have known there wasn't going to be much funding. And so I thought of AI as similar. It was an academic pursuit that was fascinating. Yeah, you know, in the back of my mind, I said, there probably is a lot more practical applications than there are of poetry, but I wasn't too worried about that.
And so after you received your PhD, you spent a year as an assistant professor at Southern Cal, so staying on the West Coast, before heading back to Berkeley as a research faculty member. So what kind of research were you doing at that time?
So it was in natural language and knowledge representation. So how do you understand language, but not just say, you know, how do I parse a sentence and figure out the noun phrases and the verb phrases, but how do I really understand what's going on and be able to, you know, do things like answer questions that you would get on an SAT test of what's happening in this story.
So after Berkeley, you moved around from Sun Microsystems Labs to Harlequin to Jungly, where your jobs range from senior scientist to chief designer to chief scientist. Can you talk a little bit about the work that you did during this period?
Yeah. So I think I was, you know, it's like when you're a scuba diver and you have to come up, you want to not get the bend so you don't decompress so fast. So I was sort of deeply into academics, and I felt the need to escape from that, but I had to do it slowly. We didn't have the word big data then, but I knew that's what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to look at large amounts of text, try to understand it, large knowledge bases, and try to build systems that could deal with that. And I saw that as a new assistant professor, I was never going to be able to put together the funds to be able to do that. You know, I could buy a couple computers and maybe I could have a couple grad students, but I could never have a large team in academia. And I saw that industry was very interested in doing that. So I moved over, and I did that first with a research lab at Sun Microsystems that was very academically oriented. And then from then on, I sort of moved to companies that were more application oriented rather than research oriented.
Hmm.
In 1998, you came to NASA Ames Research Center to serve as the division chief of the Computational Sciences Division. At the time, I was on leave from IHMC and serving as the associate center director at NASA Ames. I recall recruiting you to come to NASA. I felt that the Computational Sciences Division was at a key juncture at that point. And frankly, your arrival gave me confidence about its future as I returned to IHMC the following year. NASA Ames is an interesting place. Can you talk a little bit about your experiences there?
Yeah, and you did a great job of recruiting, so congratulations on that. I had certainly known about NASA Ames for quite a while. You read the research papers and you saw people like Peter Cheesman and Brian Williams and David Wolpert and Pandu Nayak were there at NASA. They were publishing very influential work. And so I knew that as a place that was doing important work. But I didn't think about it that much, even though it was, only a few miles away from where I lived. And then the announcement came out, and some of my friends and you asked if I was interested, and I wanted to learn more about it. It was a change for me from going from being kind of a frontline leader of a small group working on a specific project to being the lead of a whole division working a large number of projects. So that was a change in what I was doing. Wasn't clear if that was the right direction for me, but it was something I was interested in trying. And NASA seemed like a great place to do it, both because of the quality of the people there and the excitement of the mission.
Indeed, they benefited substantially by your time there. I recall that you and I gave a tag team invited plenary address at the 1999 conference of the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence. Our talk was called AI and Space Exploration, Where No Machine Has Gone Before. I still like that title. I recall that was a lot of fun. It was sort of a tag team operation.
Yeah, that's right. I certainly remember that too. And that was one opportunity to introduce what was going on at NASA. And I think it probably helped us in recruiting more people and getting people within AI excited about the opportunities. And I think it was a great opportunity that here, we're trying to explore the solar system and the universe. And it's very expensive and dangerous to send humans out into that environment. And so doing robotic exploration is a great alternative. I think at the time, much more so than a lot of the terrestrial opportunities for robots. So it was a great place to be doing robotics, to be doing autonomy where it was really needed. And I think we were able to push the boundaries and make some advances. I also learned a lot about how politics and sort of missions go. I remember going down to JPL and saying to the mission commanders there, hey, we've got some great new technology that we think could really help on your mission, and we're willing to volunteer to help you out. And the answer would always be, yeah, I really love new technology. I'll fly any new technology that's been used successfully on three previous missions.
Yeah. I don't know if you recall, but in the Deep Space One mission, which was really in many ways the first, substantial autonomy in space, and it was software. Right, there was no additional hardware. There was a mission leader that said, "Well, we don't want to use this because we're over our mass limit. We just can't have any more mass on the spaceship." And I was like, "What?"
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So we had to convince them that the one bits were no heavier than the zero bits, and
it
would probably be okay.
And that's what they were worried about. It was those one bits.
Yeah. And I do remember, I'd been in industry for a while before coming to NASA. And so this notion of launch dates for products was very important. You didn't want to miss the launch date or delay it. And I thought, well, that's true in industry, but it must be really true at NASA, because when they have a launch date, it's a real launch date. But I learned that was not true, if you're doing software, they're very happy to launch without it and then beam the software up later on in the mission when it's actually needed.
Yeah, much of it goes that way.
Mm-hmm. So in 1996, a couple of Stanford students developed a search algorithm that was originally known as Backrub, which led to the formation of Google in 1998. And you landed at Google in 2001 after wrapping up your time at NASA. How did that come about?
So a couple things. One is, though there were great opportunities, and I really love working with the people at NASA, dealing with government bureaucracy can be wearing on you. In late 2000, you'll remember we had a presidential election. You'll remember it took longer than normal to figure out who won that election. But while we were figuring that out, both candidates had said that they had planned to replace the NASA administrator. And so I looked at that and I said, you know, there's going to be about a year where nothing happens, where we wait for the new person to come in and then the new person gets started and so on. And so if you're going to leave, this would be a good time to do it because you could like save a year. And I'd been looking around at what some other opportunities are. Again, I knew I wanted to work in this area of big data, and Google seemed to be where the data was. And it also amassed a great team of people similar to the great team at NASA. And so that looked like the right opportunity at the right time.
So when you were at NASA, you worked on developing software for robotic spacecraft, such as the Mars rover. In terms of organization and bureaucracy, Google and NASA probably could not be any more different. And I'd be interested to hear your thoughts about the difference in the way that NASA goes about development and the way Google does it and what you've learned between the two.
That's right. So, you know, great similarities in terms of the quality of the people that work there, great similarities in terms of clear mission that we're trying to accomplish, but couldn't be more different in terms of the bureaucracy. And, you know, I certainly remember my first meeting at Google with the budget guy. And, you know, I had carefully prepared spreadsheets saying, this is what I think I'm going to need now, and here's how I think I'm going to need to grow. The budget guy comes in and says, yeah, that looks fine. And I says, but, you know, what if we grow 20% instead of 15%? Oh, it doesn't matter. You know, we'll find them. We got plenty of money. We'll find it. Just grow as fast as you can. And the only costs that matter is opportunity costs of things that we're not doing that we could be doing. And so go out and hire every single person you can find who's qualified to do the job, and we'll grow as fast as we can. So that's quite a bit different,
I'll say,
than the experience at NASA.
That sounds like NASA during Apollo, basically.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot of similarities there. Whereas when I was at NASA, it was quite different, you know, and I learned that the purpose of government is not to optimize where your tax dollars are spent, but to be very careful about the appearance of fairness in how it's done. So I remember a team coming to me once saying, we have this decision to make, we can buy some software or we can build it ourselves. And we've done this analysis and there's only one vendor in the world that makes the software. And here's why we think it makes more sense to buy it than to try to make it ourselves. And I looked at that analysis and says, that's a great analysis. And if I was at a company like Google, we would have bought it that day. But it turned out to be above the threshold, which meant we have to put together a request for proposal. We have to put together a review board. We have to gather all the proposals. And then some number of months later, we'll select the one vendor who really had any chance of doing it at all because they had already done it and nobody else did. So that kind of thing's, you know, you want to have those checks and balances in government so that you don't have corruption, but it definitely slows you down.
Indeed. One of your many contributions to the field of AI has been a very popular textbook on AI that you did with Stuart Russell. It has been through, I think, three editions since it originally came out in 1995. And during that time, you've seen the field of AI change somewhat dramatically and witness cycles of hype and disappointment, as well as great achievement. Considering how fast things are evolving in the field, are you at all considering a new version of your textbook?
Yeah, we're working on it now. I guess we're a little over halfway done, maybe two-thirds done. Hoping to get finished sometime around the end of the year. In the past, we've always been late, but we'll see how it goes this time around. And it is quite different this time in a number of ways. So one is there's been all this success of deep learning techniques, and we try to cover that well. We got a contribution of a chapter from Ian Goodfellow, who was one of the co-authors on the most popular book on deep learning. So he's tried to condense that into one chapter. There's also a lot of ethical issues that we did cover in the past, in our past editions, but are much more prominent now, of where should you apply AI and not apply it? How does it affect unemployment? How does it affect privacy? How does it affect military? And what is the responsibility of someone working in the field? And so we're going to cover that a lot more. And then, of course, there's small to large advances in every subfield, and we try to do that as well.
I'm sure it'll be wonderfully received. I'm glad you're doing that.
And so AI programming itself has changed over time with new languages, tools, and communities. So how are things different these days, for better or worse, for the practicing AI professional compared to when you were getting started?
Yeah. So when I started, you know, the AI programmers were considered weird. We had our own programming language. Lisp was the most popular one. Prolog was another one that was used by kind of a subset of the community. And not many people outside of AI used those languages. And then some of us even had our own computers that were made specially to do AI. And I think the reason for that didn't really have that much to do with AI per se, but it had more to do with the field of research. Standard software engineering, you got a specification of here's a program I'm trying to build. And then the hard part is dealing with the complexity of the program's going to be long and complicated, and there's lots of things to deal with, and dealing with the efficiency of, say, in the 70s or 80s, computers were much less powerful, and so you had to squeeze out all the power you could. And so the languages were optimized for that. Whereas the AI languages, when you start doing AI programming, you don't really know what you're trying to do. You don't have a clear specification. And so the AI languages and programming systems were optimized for exploration. And now I think those two have really come together in that all types of programming, you don't always have a clear specification going in, and you're not as concerned with eking out the last bit of performance because computers are so much faster now than they were back then. And so even standard programming is more like this exploratory approach, and so we no longer need specialized AI languages. And I think the other thing that's happened is that we've moved away from handwritten code and more towards machine learning, where we feed a lot of data into a system and have it try to optimize what the best moves are. And so now we have these large packages that are designed to do machine learning, and you're kind of programming on top of the packages rather than programming directly to the programming languages.
There's an apprehension amongst many in the AI community that winter is coming, so to speak. And they see this as a partial result of the current overhyping of AI in some circles, especially with regard to machine learning. Do you have any thoughts on the relationship between reality and some of the inflated expectations that one often hears, which inflate both fears as well as utopian dreams?
I guess from the inside, I think it looks different than from the outside. You know, so from my point of view, I look at tasks that we've been doing for decades, things like speech recognition, and say, well, you know, we've been making steady progress. And yes, it is an exciting time. In the last few years, the slope of that graph is increasing, so we're making more rapid progress. But I still see it as not revolutionary, but as, you know, we keep making progress on all these things and we put them together. And I think what happens is, to the outside, you only really notice when a technology passes a certain threshold. So something like speech recognition or handwriting recognition or object recognition, where you take a photo and try to figure out who or what is in the photo. We've been doing that for a long time, and you get better and better percentages. But then there comes a threshold where you say, well, now it's actually useful to have an application that does that. I want something on my phone that does speech recognition. Whereas a couple of years ago, it was a few percent worse, and it wasn't worth having that application because it was more trouble to correct it than it was to use it. So I think we're in a lot of places where we're passing that threshold, and so people are seeing these things as if they came out of nowhere, whereas from the inside, it seems like they're just increasing bit by bit. And I think in terms of public perception, you're always going to have these cycles that reporters want to write something new. So the first thing new they write is, here's this cool technology that came out of nowhere, isn't it great? And then when they've written a couple of those stories, they have to have something else to write. So now they say, here's the negative or the bad parts of these technologies, and let's write about that. So I think we'll continue to have these cycles, but the applications will continue to get better and more useful.
In the past, the perception of AI, the level of funding it received, and the attraction of young talent were largely dependent on government research programs. Do you think things will be different because AI is being driven largely by commercial interests now? I'm curious as to your thoughts.
Yeah, so I think there's always a switch and a balance. And so for a long time, I think that's exactly right, that most of the funding came out of the government. Now it seems like the government's trying to do cost cutting there and not do that. Industry is picking up the slack. In some places, philanthropy is also picking up the slack. So Paul Allen has two research institutes, one specifically on AI and one on the brain and neuroscience that's related to AI. Jim Simons has an institute with a similar kind of focus. So to me, you know, as long as the research continues, I don't know if it matters that much where the funding comes from. And I do think that we're doing a great job of sharing the work, you know, so people worry, well, maybe if more of the work is in industry and less in academia, that it'll be less shared. But I think we're actually sharing a lot more. We're sharing code with the open source software much more than we did, you know, in the 80s. I would write code and maybe I'd share it with a couple of my friends, but there was no way to really publish it and get it out to the world at large. Now that's done all the time. And we're also to some extent disrupting the journal articles, going straight to archive and putting up these preprints as soon as we make them. And so it seems like there's more sharing now and more open research than there was in the past.
And over the past 10 years, the look and the feel of Google's web search doesn't seem to have changed that much. So why is that?
I think we wanted to make things simple. We wanted to give the user a simple model of what you do, is that you type in some words and we give you some results. And we didn't see a need for that to change fundamentally. From the inside, it does look like there's lots and lots of change. You know, we continually get better at what those results are. Are pre-processing more, so we start giving you potential answers and auto-completing your queries as you're doing it. We hadn't done that before. And we have these specialized results, so we might show you a map if your query has to do with the location of something. We might show you directly some videos or pictures if your query has to do with that, whereas in the past, you would have to explicitly click over to those tabs. So we are making a lot of changes, but we're also trying to keep the same look and feel to make it easy for the users to understand what they can do.
And key reasons the Google search engine has flourished for nearly 20 years are its performance, including speed, relevance, coverage, and other search criteria. And Google is still the gold standard in search. So how does Google test for performance and criteria such as those that I just mentioned?
Right. So certainly there's a lot of testing going on. Every query, we're measuring whatever we can of feedback of how long did this one take? Did the user click on the first result? If they did, that's probably good. But if they clicked on the first result and then immediately came back and clicked on something else, then maybe it's not good. So we track all that and try to make improvements based on the click logs. Then we also have human evaluations where we say we'll take some sample queries. It can't be all the queries, so the amount of data is less. We take some sample queries and we give those to some human raters and say, are these good answers? Is this one a good one? Is this one a good one? Or maybe here's two versions of our algorithm, the current one and a projected future one, and which of these two is better? And we get those answers from the human raters and we fold that into the statistics we have. And then finally, we do at an even deeper level, we'll like take volunteers and take them sort of into the lab or go visit them in their home. And they volunteer to let us watch them as they're trying to do their searches. And there we're measuring not so much where the clicks are, but how do they think about the process and when do they get confused? And we don't get as much analytical data there, but we get ideas for new things to try. So we're always collecting data at multiple levels and trying to integrate it all and make things better.
Mm-hmm. About a decade ago, Google seemed slightly disparaging about the utility of AI, but then the company seemed to rather suddenly change its tune. Of course, this is the view from the outside. This was, in my view, probably because of the sudden explosion of applications of deep learning, which when applied to very large data yielded numerous state-of-the-art results in domains such as speech recognition, image recognition, language translation, and many other important AI application areas. Corporations have invested billions of dollars at this point. For our listeners, can you briefly explain what deep learning is, what it does well, and what the word deep means in this context?
Okay, great question. So first, machine learning means learning from examples. So you show a system a bunch of examples and say, do more like this, or figure out how to optimize that and go ahead and do that. And that's compared to traditional programming where a programmer sits down and says, okay, in situation A, I'm going to do this, and in situation B, I'm going to do something else. And traditional programming, you have to understand what's going on in order to be able to figure out what the right answer is. And in machine learning, you may not have to figure it out yourself. If you have enough of the right examples, you can figure out how to do that. And so you can think of machine learning as saying we're trying to learn a function. We're trying to learn a mapping from the input to the output. And if we have lots of examples of inputs and the proper outputs, then maybe we can go ahead and learn that mapping. What deep learning says is that we don't have to do that all in one step. We don't have to map directly from the input to the output. We can go through intermediate steps. And it came up first in the area of computer vision, where we said, we want to recognize what's in this picture. Is this a cat or a dog or something else? And you could just show it lots of examples of here's a bunch of cat pictures, here's a bunch of dog pictures, feed that into an algorithm and have it come out with the answer. But when we tried to do that and have the inputs connected immediately to the outputs, it just didn't work very well. People were getting a couple things right, but mostly they were getting them wrong. Then we said, maybe what's missing is some intermediate representation. When I see a picture, I don't go directly from the pixels in the picture to saying that's a cat. Rather, I need to build up pieces. I need to say, here's the face of the cat, here are the eyes, here are the nose, here are the whiskers, here are the paws, put them together. Now I can say it's a cat. So deep learning says we're going to put in those intermediate levels. Instead of having one level going from input to output, we're going to have multiple levels. So the first level will be the pixels. The next level will be maybe we can pick up some lines in the picture. Then the next level will be we'll pick up small components like the eyes and the nose. The next will pick up larger components like the face. And the next will pick up the whole component like the cat. And the thing about deep learning that made it more successful than past approaches is that we didn't have to pre-program in what each of those layers were. We didn't have to have this expectation of we're looking exactly for this at each point. Rather, we just gave the computer just the right amount of freedom for it to be able to discover those things on its own, discover which components are important and what level they should be at. And sometimes our perceptions of how we do these things are wrong. And so when we tried to pre-program them in, they didn't work that well. So I can recognize a cat, but I can't sit down and write by hand a program to do that because the way I recognize it is subconscious or unconscious and not conscious. So I don't have any access to how I do it. But I can program a computer to do it by saying, this is about the amount of freedom I want to give the computer and then tell it to optimize all the representations. If you give it too much freedom, then it takes too long for it to figure out what the right answer is. If you give it not enough freedom, then it can't represent everything it needs to represent. Maybe it can represent the eyes, but it can't represent the face, and now it gets lost. And so the trick is figuring out what's the happy medium. And so basically, we just feed in all the examples, try multiple different models for how much freedom we should give it, and then see which one works the best.
Yeah, that's great. So what are some of the limitations and assumptions and methods such as deep learning?
In deep learning, what we're always trying to do is say, can we represent what's important? Can we figure out what are in these hidden middle layers, not in the input and not in the output, that's important to understanding what's going on? These things like the eyes and noses and so on. And with pictures, it's usually pretty easy to do that because we have this model that it's important that pixels are near each other. And so we build computer components that understand that. And most of the stuff, the pixels that are near each other in the image are also near each other in real life. Now, of course, in real life, we're looking at 3D stuff. So sometimes two pixels might be near each other and one's in the foreground and one's in the background. So they aren't actually part of the same thing. But the models we have can figure that out pretty well. So when we have difficulties is when there's something that's not represented in the input at all, but is important to understand in order to figure out what's going on. Some component that's invisible, but it's kind of background knowledge that people know about, but not represented in the input, so the computer doesn't know about it. And if we have examples like that, then it becomes harder.
Mm-hmm. Another notorious challenge for systems like deep learning in some domains is an inability to explain how it came to that state. You gave the example of a human being's inability to do that. And these systems share that to some extent, a relative opacity with respect to how it came to that answer. And I know there's a lot of work aimed currently at addressing that. There's a DARPA program and lots of other work.
Yeah, I think that's very important. You do see some of it talked about under the heading of explainability, and I think that's not quite the most important heading. I would rather talk about trustability, that you want to have a system that you have trust in, that it's going to get the answer right most of the time, and when it doesn't, you want to understand what's going on. And an explanation is helpful for that, but an explanation is not the only thing that you need. It's neither necessary nor sufficient. You know, so explanations are a story that leave out a lot of details. And sometimes that story is important, but sometimes that story can be misleading. And we know that experts have explanations all the time, and they're not always right. You look at, you know, the experts say in the stock market, they'll have two very coherent explanations, one for if the market goes up and one for if the market goes down. And if you ask them to do it ahead of time, they get it right about half the time. And if you ask them to do it after the fact, they always choose the right explanation.
Amazing.
Yeah. So that's telling me that maybe explanations aren't always the right thing. You know, similarly, if I go to a doctor, I want a diagnosis, and I definitely want that explanation for the diagnosis. But I think the generating the explanation, I think, is a different problem than doing the diagnosis. So I go to the doctor, I explain my symptoms, and she says, I think you have X. And I think the way she does that is she's drawing on her decades of experience in a mostly subconscious way. And then when I ask for the explanation, then she goes back to her medical school training and says, here's all the arguments for this diagnosis that I've already made, and I'm going to skip the arguments against them. The explanation is useful, but it's not always reliable.
Yes, indeed. I think explanation it's unfortunate that that's the term, because it's sort of left over from the knowledge-based system days, where in some ways it actually made more sense. But opacity might be another way to say it. You know, one would like to have confidence. Trust is one kind of confidence, but one would like to know how the outcome was produced.
Right. I agree with that. I think opacity would be a much better word. Mm. So I want to have things like saying, okay, I told you the situation and the machine came back and it gave this recommendation. Now I want to be able to have a conversation, right? So I want to be able to say, well, how did you get there? What if here's another scenario that's a little bit different? Would that have changed the result?
Mm.
You know, or no, if that wouldn't change it, well, how much would I have had to have changed the input in order to get a different result, you know, and have that kind of back and forth dialogue, I think that's more helpful than just generating an explanation.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
Back in the day, good old-fashioned AI, as it used to be called, or sometimes still is called, GoFi, raised many big philosophical questions that were either fun for people like me or annoying for many others. And this sort of depended on your perspective and background. And these were big questions, though, like, what does it mean to be intelligent? Does it need to be human-like? What is a mind? Can a machine be conscious? I'm sure you remember all of these and many more.
Yeah, and I remember some of your papers where it looked like you were both having fun and being annoyed.
Exactly, Peter. The annoyance led to the fun. And these questions are compelling enough for the general public as well as philosophically oriented people to be the basis of popular sci-fi movies like Blade Runner or Ex Machina. Are there new big questions, in your view, that are being raised in the context of the newer forms of AI that are, you know, in some ways statistical in nature?
Yeah, I think there are new questions. I think, you know, the old questions, as you say, had to do with, okay, say a computer can do something. Does that mean it's really intelligent or is it just faking intelligence? And to me, that was never that interesting. And I remember, so I was a new grad student at Berkeley in 1980, and we had some of the main philosophers who were going into that field, John Searle and Bert Dreyfus. And I remember, you know, Searle had this argument that computers could never be really intelligent because they were just made out of the wrong stuff, that you had to be made out of neurons and not made out of electrons. And I could never understand how he came to that conclusion. But I remember my thesis advisor, Bob Walensky, saying, well, you know, what if there, you had a robot and you interacted with it and you could talk to it and it was, you know, acting just like your friend? Wouldn't you attribute to it some real feeling? And I remember Searle saying, yeah, I admit I probably would, but deep down I would know it's not real. And so I guess to me that distinction maybe is not that important. I think we as a species, you know, we always want to be seen as unique and special, and we've had various challenges to that over our history. Copernicus challenged whether our planet was the center of the universe, and Darwin challenged whether we were unique from all the other animals, and now AI is challenging whether we're unique from other thinking things or reasoning things. And to me, I'm not so worried about being special. I think we can do what we do, and computers can do what they do, and I don't feel challenged by that.
Well, birds are not diminished by aircraft.
Exactly.
You know, you mentioned Hubert Dreyfus and John Searle with his Chinese room argument. Back in the 90s, Pat Hayes and I developed this award we called the Simon Newcomb Award, and we accepted nominations, but we very carefully selected the winners. Mm-hmm. And this award was for the most wrong-headed argument against the possibility of intelligent machines. And Searle was not surprisingly one of the winners for the Chinese room.
A well-deserved victory.
It was. I think he's proud of it. And Hubert Dreyfus, we couldn't find anything with the form of an argument. We looked at everything he had written.
You know, I actually really appreciate what Dreyfus did. So he wrote this book, What Computers Can't Do. But I think really what it should have been called is What Expert System Technology of the 60s and 70s Can't Do. And there, I think he had a lot of really helpful criticism.
I didn't think so. I thought they were assertions, not arguments. Like, can you remember an argument that he made?
So as I remember, and, you know, this may be projecting my own interpretation on it rather than his original one, because it's been a long time. But I remember him saying, well, you know, these systems are just brittle, and they're using Boolean logic when they should be using something softer or fuzzier. And I think that turned out to be exactly right.
Well, I don't think the brittleness was a function of Boolean logic, but in any case, we were unable to ascertain anything with the form of an argument, so we didn't want to neglect him for his extensive body of work. So we gave him a Lifetime Achievement Award. I note that the papers at the National AI Conference, although technically often quite excellent, are typically sort of statistical in nature and rather narrowly cast. Perhaps this is a sign of a field maturing, or perhaps a field ducking the hard and interesting questions, or a little bit of each. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think one thing that's happened that has both helped and hurt is a reliance on metrics, that in various fields, we set up tasks and we say, how well can you do on this? So in natural language, here's a corpus of sentences and you have to parse them. And what percentage did you get right? And the last guy got 96% right. So if you have a paper that does 97%, then you're probably going to get it published. And if you get 92%, you're probably not going to get it published. And I think that does help move the field forward, but it also retards new ideas because it takes time to build up a new technology. If you say, I'm going to take what already exists and I'm going to make one small tweak to it, then if you have the right idea, you're probably going to increase the score and you get a publishable paper. But if you say, I think the whole field's going in the wrong direction and I'm going to start over from scratch, well, your first couple of papers probably are not going to be anywhere near the right score because, you know, there's been hundreds or thousands of person years worth of effort in building up the current approach. And if you start from scratch on a new approach, you're not going to surpass it for a long time. And so this emphasis on scores kind of suppresses the idea of here's a new idea. It looks promising. I can't prove it yet. I don't have the numbers that say it looks promising, but I'm going to lay out my arguments for why I believe it.
Right.
Those kind of papers are harder to get accepted now.
Mm. Exactly. That's what I've noticed, too.
Mm. I'm curious, Peter, do you see more traditional, largely symbolic AI methods having much of a future? And if so, why?
I think we need to be able to abstract away from pattern recognition immediately on the inputs, which is a lot of what we're doing now. And we have some ability to do that abstraction. I think, you know, in the past, we tried to do that by the blood, sweat, and tears of graduate students writing by hand rules for what's up. And I think that that's not a very successful approach. And we've had various attempts to try to do that, and it hasn't gotten that far. So I think to make progress, we're going to continue to use machine learning more than we're going to use knowledge engineering of writing stuff by hand. But we want those representations to be at all level of abstractions. And so we're going to have to figure out, you know, we've done a good job of figuring out how to do pixels and how to do sounds and other inputs that are near the signal processing level. And it gets harder and harder as we get to the more abstract level. But I think we do need to continue to concentrate on that.
I can imagine in the future, hybrid sorts of architectures will be increasingly important.
Yeah.
So let's shift gears a little bit and go back to Google for a minute and talk about search function and privacy. In addition to search, Google provides some of the web's most used and appreciated software, including Gmail, Docs, Drive, Calendar, and more. Google's access to vast amounts of personal data means that its search results can be personalized in clever ways, and advertising can be targeted to a specific given individual. That said, many are increasingly concerned about the loss of privacy and the use of personal information, and this has given rise, as you know, to much dialogue, but also to alternative search engines that cannot really provide these personalized search results, such as DuckDuckGo, but which describes itself as the search engine that doesn't track you. Depending on one's perspective on privacy, this is either one of DuckDuckGo's best or worst features, and I wondered if you had thoughts on this.
So we want to give people control. We feel like their data is theirs and they have control of it. If they want to log in to use our services, then we'll know it's them, and what they do is appended to their history to the extent that they want us to do that. If they want to come in and not log in, or if they want to set their settings to not remember what's going on, we want to give them the ability to do that. If they want to take all their data and go someplace else, we have a ability for you to check out everything you have and say goodbye. So we believe people should have control of their own data, and we want to continually try to improve our ability to explain what the options are and what they can do. And then sometimes it's hard to make that explanation because things are so complicated. You know, you mentioned personalization of targeting of results, and that's true. That's something we do want to be able to do. I think a lot of people think of that as being more important than it is. If you actually went around to your friends and you know, looked at the results they get, they're more similar than they are different. So there really isn't that much personalization. So there's definitely localization. So, you know, if you're in one country, you get different results than if you're in another. You search for a name, you get the thing that's close to you. That's important. I often said that if you gave me a choice, I can have for users in a search session, and you can have either the last 5 minutes of their history or their whole lifetime up to 5 minutes ago. Usually I'd rather have the last 5 minutes, because what they're doing now is more important than what they've done in the past. And I think that's different from us. You know, so if you compare, say, to Amazon, there they have the records of your past purchases, and that's pretty predictive of your future purchases. You know, so I probably jazz music is my favorite, so I'm probably going to continue that. I'm probably not going to overnight switch into a big hip-hop craze. But for Google, it's not really like that. In Google, all the time, I'm coming in and I'm searching about something that I've never searched about before. And so the personalization, I think, plays much less of a role than a lot of the public thinks.
So, Peter, I know you said it's not a huge component, but there's an example of personalizing Google search, and you can kind of look at things like sending recommendations for news articles based off of recent search. And some people would argue that sending people news articles based on their history is not necessarily a good thing, and instead is contributing to the polarization we now see in our politics. And it may be that soon each of us will only hear news that comports with our existing views. To some extent, this has already happened. When people bring that up, what's your response?
I guess I'd like to understand more about that. I don't have a complete picture. I have seen a lot of survey results that say that people are actually getting a wider variety of views from using the internet than they have in the past, because it just is so much easier to branch out into multiple directions. So I guess I'm not as worried about this idea of polarization. I think that comes in more in people's outputs rather than their inputs, right? So I think people are exposed to different points of view, and the problem is that they just reject or don't even consider some of them rather than that they're not seeing it at all. You know, one thing I've been working on is education to say, how can you do a better job of teaching people how to think critically and how to evaluate what makes sense and what doesn't make sense? Because I think this is a new skill that's more important that, you know, you go back 50 years, there were much fewer sources of news and they were all kind of homogeneous. And so differentiating between them wasn't that important, right? I mean, you still had to be critical thinking. You had to say, you know, is what Walter Cronkite is telling me about what's going on in the Vietnam War, is how much of that is true versus false? But you didn't have ABC, NBC, and CBS giving you completely different points of view. They were all pretty homogeneous. And now you have a wide variety of points of view, and some of them are completely fabricated. Some of them are satirical articles that people confuse for actual articles. Some of them are slanted from different points of view, and it's much harder to figure that out than it was in the past. And so one of the things I've been involved in is trying to say, can we come up with curriculums to help people navigate through that and understand better how to evaluate what's true and what's not?
That's fantastic. And speaking of that, Google is described as part of the information industry, which, along with energy, has become one of the dominant branches of commerce worldwide. But in this age of things like tweeting or quote-unquote fake news and international trolling, do we really know what quote-unquote information means? Or is the very meaning of the word changing? And I'm curious, does Google feel that it has any kind of responsibility in this regard?
Yeah, so I guess there's a couple different meanings of information, right? So if you go back to Shannon, he tried to duck the issue of fake news by saying information is just what gets transmitted and is up to you to make sense of what it means. And I think those are two different aspects. And of course, we're more interested in the value of the information rather than in the number of bits. And it's hard to make that evaluation. And I guess we're participating in some consortiums to try to put some ratings on that, to make some reviews, to have some guidelines for what is proper journalism, what does make sense. But that's becoming harder as there's so much freedom now for anybody to proclaim themselves a publisher, and there's a low barrier to entry, whereas in the past it was a much higher barrier.
In recent times, we see large tech companies that some regard as platform monopolies aggressively shadow banning and deplatforming various voices, as we were just discussing earlier. And this topic is receiving a lot of attention, especially right now. And it raises the issue of how society will construe the role of companies like Google, Facebook, and many others. Is the role akin to a publisher, meaning responsibility for content, libel, and the rest? Or is it like a regulated public utility of some kind, which would mean a regulatory structure? Or is it some other model? It seems that the legal framework hasn't caught up with the technological reality in some ways.
Well, we certainly have legal frameworks, but now there's arguments over what falls under what framework. And I think we go back to the very start of this conversation and talk about tools, and that's where I see the role of these companies, in that they're providing tools for people to publish information. So maybe the analogy is to a pencil manufacturer or pencil and paper manufacturers together, that they provide the capability for people to put out some information, but you don't hold the pencil manufacturer responsible for whether the things written with that pencil are correct or not.
Yes, but the pencil can write all kinds of opinions. In other words, the pencil manufacturer isn't editing or deciding what is good journalism. The pencil is neutral.
Right. And so now the question is, what are the bounds of what gets published on a platform, and what is the responsibility of the platform provider? And I think that's where I was going with the question.
Right. That's a tough question.
Right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So we certainly have rules on things you can do. And, you know, the rules vary from country to country, but there are restrictions on things like pornography. In Germany, there's restrictions on Nazi propaganda and so on. And so the platform providers have to go along with those legal restrictions where they operate. You know, we have the DMCA, which says the platform providers are not responsible for making sure whatever gets published on their platform is true, that that's up to the reader to make sense of that rather than up to the publisher. And I think that restriction has enabled the growth of a lot of this industry, and it would have been hindered quite a bit if it had been the responsibility of the publisher to decide.
Hmm. Yeah, I utterly agree. I think where the rub is going to come is increasingly the platform providers are deciding, for whatever reason, not just legal reasons, but ideological reasons, what will be on their site or not. So, I mean, you look at, I'm not talking about Google here in particular, but you look at some of the social media platforms, they deplatform, you know, crazy people that they don't like. And these people are definitely strange, right? But they don't deplatform equally unhinged groups with different ideology. And I think that's the hazard. If it was the way you described it, sort of open and unfettered, I think, as you said, that really accounted for much of the success and much of the growth.
Yeah. And I agree with that, that we shouldn't be banning people based on their ideological views. But I think platforms have some duty to police actions that are illegal, right? So if you're advocating violence against someone, then probably makes sense for the publisher to take that down.
Right.
Rather, but if you're, you know, advocating one political candidate over another, it doesn't make sense to restrict that.
Does it matter who's advocating the violence? So if an ISIS Facebook page is advocating violence or Antifa is advocating violence, would they be looked at the same way?
Ideally, they should, right?
So I agree.
There should be rules that says, here's what's legal and here's what's not, but yeah, they shouldn't say that one group has specific rights over another.
I totally concur.
So companies such as PowerSet, among others, see natural language search as the future, and this would allow people to use sentences to search rather than keywords. So what's your take on this?
Yeah, so certainly we've seen a change as we move more to mobile and more to voice. Right. So that's a change of people found it more convenient to carry their computers with them in their pocket in increasing numbers. And we're now seeing more searches over mobile than we were from the desktop. So that's a change. And people just interact differently on the phone. So if you're on the phone and you're fumbling with your thumbs on the keyboard, then your queries are shorter. But if you're on the phone and you're using speech recognition, then your queries are longer and they're more sentence-like rather than keyword-like. And so we try to respond to that and build our search results accordingly.
So last year, I turned the tables on Ken and interviewed him for STEM Talk. In case some of our listeners missed it, check out episodes 49 and 50. So I asked Ken at one point about a New York Times story that had referenced a meeting Elon Musk had with governors where he said they should adopt AI legislation before robots. And this is a quote, "start going down the street killing people." So I'm curious, do you buy into this killer robot theory?
I don't really understand that. And I certainly don't understand Elon Musk. I do like the idea that we should look carefully at this and start to get ahead of it. That, you know, if you look at any new technology, it has positive benefits and it also has negative side effects. So we invented the internal combustion engine a little over 100 years ago, and that's led to great advances in terms of being able to deliver food to everyone a lot easier than we could in the past. But it also leads to deaths and automobile crashes, and it leads to pollution and so on. So if somebody had been thinking more carefully 100 years ago of, hey, where is this going and how should we be dealing with it, that would have been a good thing. Another example would be antibiotics, which have saved billions of lives, but now we've bred these antibiotic-resistant diseases. And if somebody had thought about that at the invention of the technology and said, let's prepare for that, that would have been a good thing. So certainly I want to prepare for what's happening with robotics and automation. But I'm not really worried at all about the Terminator scenario. I think in movies, you got to have an exciting plot. I think there's also this idea of typecasting, right? So you're planning a movie and you say, I have this robot and I have this attractive human famous actor, and I have two roles, the bad guy and the good guy. Who's going to get what? Well, the robot always gets typecast as the bad guy, right?
Yeah. Stiff-legged.
So that's just the way it goes. So I think there will be unintended side effects of these technologies, but I think killer robots in the street is not one of them. And I don't really understand where Elon Musk is coming from. I do think that some of that may be the press's fault, although some of it is his fault as well, probably.
Oh, yeah.
But I remember seeing a press report from Sir Martin Rees, the Royal Astronomer of England, expressing similar types of concerns. And I looked at that report and I said, this is just kind of crazy. But then I got a chance to meet him in real life, and we sat down and had a conversation, and everything he said was completely reasonable. So in that case, it was the reporter's fault in translating what he said and not his fault at all. Hmm. So I'm giving Musk the benefit of the doubt, and maybe he falls in that category as well. Although with every tweet, that seems increasingly less likely.
No, yeah. I find it personally interesting, and I imagine you do too, that after decades of pundits and philosophers arguing that AI is provably impossible, suddenly that argument has been replaced with the assertion that not only is it possible, but that some kind of superhuman AI is so inevitable that it represents the greatest danger ever faced by the human race. So in only about a decade or a decade and a half, the conversation has shifted from you can't do it to you shouldn't do it. And this sort of follows up on our previous discussion, and I imagine you've noted the same.
Yeah, that's certainly true. You know, it's like the old joke of, oh, this restaurant, the food is terrible, and the portions are so small.
So when you were in Australia last year, the Financial Times reported that one of the most commonly asked questions people threw at you about AI was, what will it mean for truck drivers? That question seems to embody the fear that algorithms, machine learning, and robots are going to eliminate all of our jobs. And your response was that the jobs of truckers and many other blue and white collar workers would not disappear because of AI. Can you explain why you said that?
So I think there'll be a shift and not an immediate disappearance. And I think the roles will change, right? So humans are still better at being humans than machines are, and they'll do more of that, right? So I think what will happen within the next decade or maybe a couple decades is we'll certainly see automation in the trucking business. The main job of the truck driver won't be to drive the truck anymore. And maybe we'll have a fleet of several trucks following each other with only one driver in the front. Maybe the driver will be sleeping overnight while the truck goes. But when you get to the delivery site, you're still going to want a human there, right? Because you still got to unload the stuff. You have to talk to the foreman at the warehouse where you're delivering. Maybe you want to push your company's services. And maybe the truck driver now becomes more of a sales representative or a customer service support representative to say, how else can we do a better job? How can we get this stuff to you faster? You know, we're delivering refrigerated goods and they're in compartments that are this size, but I can see from your warehouse floor that be more convenient for you if they were in another size carton. We can do that for you. Mm. And we have a computer system where we can integrate your inventory system with ours. So as soon as things are delivered, it's all taken care of. And I think you'll see those kinds of roles. Certainly the total number of truck drivers per truck mile is going to decrease. But if that makes trucking cheaper, then the total number of truck miles will increase, and maybe we'll need more truckers to cover for that. And so, you know, some of them will change into different roles. So mm-hmm. There'll be new opportunities and there'll be change. And I think the main issue we're facing is not the fact that there'll be change. That's always been true, right? So it used to be we built things by workers working with shovels, and we don't do that anymore. Now they have bulldozers and other devices. And that put a lot of shovel workers out of work, but they ended up doing different tasks rather than, you know, so we like to think of it in terms of tasks rather than in terms of jobs. And the tasks will certainly change. And to me, that means we need educational system or a re-educational system that says you're doing one thing now, but in the future, you may be doing something different. And we want you to be flexible enough to be able to deal with that. We want to give you the help to be able to learn these new skills.
Interestingly, following up on that, as you know, we recently hosted a meeting that you attended at IHMC on exactly this topic, the future of work as technology continues to develop and we move forward. And I have to say your explanation of the truck driver, I think, is exactly right. If anything, it elevates the position of the truck driver from only driving to sort of a logistics and management and, as you said, perhaps sales role. In many ways, it's a much better job.
Yeah, I think that will be true. I think a lot of jobs will become more interesting in that the routine parts are the easiest part to automate and the creative parts are the hardest part to automate.
Indeed. Earlier in this decade, you spoke at the Singularity Summit and remarked that you're not a believer in what some refer to as the singularity. Can you talk just briefly about what is generally meant by that term and then share your views on it?
Yeah. So in mathematics, a singularity is where a function goes off to infinity, right? So you can imagine a line sloping up and then all of a sudden it accelerates faster and faster and faster and it goes all the way off to infinity. And the idea is that once you get to that singularity point, that infinity point, you have no idea of knowing what's on the other side. So in automation, this idea of the singularity is that progress is accelerating and it's going to continue to accelerate and we're going to reach a point where all things are possible and who knows what's going to happen after that. So I'm not a believer in that. And I think part of the problem is that people look at a small class of problems and look at progress in those problems, and some of those are accelerating on this type of curve, and think that all the problems are like that. So some problems are like, say on your Google Maps, you want to find a route from where you are to where you want to go. And we can get better and better at that and smarter at saying, here's the optimal route that you want to go on. And I think we will have lots of progress on those types of problems for which we can explain what the problem is, explain what the answer is, use machine learning to optimize it, and those will continue to get better and better. But I think a lot of life is not like that. So if I said, I want to solve the Middle East crisis, I think having a faster computer or a better machine learning algorithm isn't going to get you that far, right? All it's going to mean is that the very clever machine learning algorithm is going to get frustrated faster than a human would get frustrated. And I think more of life is these messy types of problems that are not amenable to progress in automation. And so therefore, the curve for the easy parts will continue to go up and up, but the curves for these hard, messy, wicked problems will not go up. And so the net curve will not be an exponential off to infinity.
Mm-hmm. Even in applications or problems where a method like deep learning is well suited, in the recent years, we have several of the thought leaders in that field suggesting that we're beginning to see a leveling off in performance. The curve was very steep for the last 5 or 6 years. And Jeff Hinton and Marcus and others have said, Marcus, I think, used the term the wall, but it might be overly dramatic, but a sort of shift in the shape of the curve. And to me, that doesn't seem surprising, but I want to just quickly get your view on that.
Yeah, I think that's right. So I think the problems where we've seen the rapid success over the last 5 to maybe even 10 years have been kind of pattern recognition problems that are close to the input, ones that do involve some non-trivial work. And I mentioned this idea of deep learning where you need intermediate levels of representation that are not in the input or the output. So yes, you have some of that. But there are mostly things where, like, you're starting from pixels, which are very concrete, and we've seen progress in those types of errors. Now, as you say, Jeff Hinton has this idea of we've seen incremental progress using these kind of standard techniques over the last few years, but maybe we're reaching the limit. And Jeff has a proposal for a completely different architecture where he says, essentially, we want to start over and see if we can build up progress using this new approach. And I think that's right. We'll probably... Mm-hmm. We're going great now, but 10 years from now, we'll be using something completely different. And 10 years from that, we'll be using something completely different again. Although I do have a prediction that what we do in 10 years will be completely different, but we'll probably still call it deep learning because that brand name is so good.
Yeah. People take the word deep to mean profound. So yeah. When you say, oh, I use deep learning, then they stroke their chins and think, oh.
Yeah. So, if we had called it, and it must be, it was very good branding, right? I would have said something like multi-level hierarchical regression using kernel functions, and that would not have been as good branding.
Yeah.
So, Peter, right now our smartphones are dominated by apps, but a post-app era is coming where a new type of human-computer smartphone technology and interaction will take over. Is that something that Google's working on?
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And you say it's coming. I don't know where we're going to end up, but we certainly are taking some steps in that direction, right? So if you look at these speaker-based devices, the Google Home or the Alexa and Siri and so on, they're really disrupting the app model. You know, right now, if I want a car to show up at my location, I open my phone and I make the choice. Do I want to hit the little icon that says Uber or the one that says Lyft or something else? And then I'm talking directly to that company and it's sort of taken over my phone and I interact with that company. But with these speaker or assistant-based systems, we've kind of thrown that out, right? So the companies do have to provide an interface to their services, but I'm talking directly to my phone and then the phone is talking to the company. And so I might not even make the choice. I might just say, hey, get me a car. And it might go out and negotiate and find the best one. Or I say, get me a pizza. And I don't have to know which shop it comes from. The system knows my preferences or whatever. And so now we've put the phone back in charge, and that may be a good step in terms of giving users more control rather than having them, every time they select a company they want to interact with, they've ceded all control to that company. I do think that we'll, in the short term, we'll see a step backwards in terms of usability because the companies have done a good job of building their apps. And now we're saying we want to discard that app. And some of these systems, these assistants have screens on them, but most of them don't. They rely on voice interaction. And that interaction in the short term is just not going to be as good. And it reminds me of when the World Wide Web first showed up in the mid-90s, where, you know, up to then we had had PCs and you had programs running on your PC and they were pretty snappy. And, you know, you clicked on a menu item and you got an immediate response. And then we said, hey, look at this web page. It's like an application and I can click on this button and only 8 seconds later, the page will reload. And isn't that cool that it's doing it over the web? So it was a step backwards in terms of usability, but it was a step forward in thinking about what the future was going to be like. So that's where I think we are today with these assistant systems. And whether they become the dominant model or something else does, or we stick with the app model, that I'm not certain on, but I'm glad that we're exploring the possibilities.
Yeah. And you're widely quoted as saying that you have the best job in the world. So what is it exactly that you do at Google?
So I put, the last time I updated my resume was probably about a dozen years ago. And then I put that in because I was getting calls from recruiters and I wanted to cut that down. It didn't work. I still get bothered all the time.
Well, after they read that, they really love you.
Yeah. And so I've had a mix of jobs at Google. For 5 or 6 years, I ran the search team. For another 5 or 6 years, I was the director of all of research. And then as the company grew, I became a director of an increasingly smaller percentage of research as we added hundreds and hundreds of researchers to the team. My role now has actually shifted a bit. And so I've taken some time off, as I said, to work on a revision of the textbook. So my hours at Google are reduced. And a lot of my time at Google is actually spent with startup companies, some that we invest in and some that we mentor through our cloud developer platform without investing in. And what I'm interested in is how these companies do machine learning. So these are companies that aren't necessarily founded by computer scientists. They may be coming out of, say, the medical field and they have expertise there, but they say, hey, we've got some data. We want to do some of this machine learning stuff. How can we do it? How do we get started? We're finding it hard to hire PhDs because Google and Facebook and their peers got them all. So what do we do without expertise? And so I'm trying to understand what are the tools that those type of people need, which is very different from the types of tools that an expert at Google needs.
Yeah. So, Peter, a lot of our listeners are young and still in school. So, since you have the best job in the world, you seem like the ideal candidate to offer advice to those young listeners who perhaps want to come work for Google. So, what is your advice?
There's two things. One is to prepare with the right background. So, take courses in computer science, take courses in statistics, take courses in machine learning if that's available. And the second is to show an interest in making stuff and solving problems. So maybe get involved with an open source project or find something that you're interested in and say, here's a tough problem that I pursued and here's what I was able to do to solve it.
Good advice.
I think that's the kind of person we're looking for.
Good advice. I know that you and your wife greatly enjoy cycling. Have you picked up any other new hobbies?
Yeah, so I guess as you get older, some of the choices are more limited. So cycling is good for me. You know, I used to be a basketball and frisbee player, but now all the players are faster than me. But cycling, I don't care. I can go at my own speed. And I guess my other hobby is photography, which is something that I enjoy.
Well, Peter, it's been fantastic having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it was great, yes. Peter. Really good.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Thank you.
STEM Talk.
So I can certainly understand now why Peter says he has the best job in the world. He is at the center of so much of what is shaping our world today, and especially our world of tomorrow.
But he's wrong about that. I have the best job in the world. As you've probably picked up, neither Peter or I embrace the notion that AI research is a grave threat to humanity. Many things are dangerous. It's about the wisdom with which we use these things. In this respect, technology is neutral and does not convey an inherent moral component. Whether we will, as a species, apply our technology with sufficient thought and wisdom, now that very much remains in question.
I hope a key takeaway for our listeners today is that we are fortunate to have someone like Peter, who is working so hard on the potential of AI and the many ways that it can enhance our lives. If you enjoyed this interview as much as we did, we invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage, where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes, stemtalk.us. This is Don Cornegus signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others, so please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.